We're going to make a start. So welcome everybody to this evening's event. My name is Tanya Burkhart and I'm Director of the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion, and it's a privilege to be chairing the event this evening and the launch of this very important report, Switching Focus, that Liz here on my right has written. The title, Switching Focus, refers to the fact that there's been for too long too much focus on changing disabled people to fit into rigid labour market and employment structures. And the proposals in front of us today are about switching the focus to a strategy based on greater accountability of employers and shared responsibilities between employers and the state and governments, shared risk-taking between employers and government in order to produce a step change in employment rates and employment conditions for disabled people. It comes at a time of major demographic change. So we not only have an ageing population, but we have more people wanting to work longer as well as live longer, and we have more people with long-term health conditions, either in work or wanting to work. So a time of demographic change, but also, of course, fundamentally a time of considerable changes in the labour market, with greater automation and a greater range of employment contracts, for better or worse. In many ways, both of these present themselves as a challenge, the demographic change and the changes in the labour market. But I think they do also present opportunities. And one of the things that makes this report particularly timely is seizing the potential of those changes, changes in the composition of the workforce, and changes in the nature of the labour market, to effect these much more radical changes that we need. And that's what we're going to hear about from our speakers today, how to seize those opportunities and make the changes that we also very much want to see. So the format that we're going to follow is that Liz is going to introduce the report and the proposals it contains, and then we'll hear from the distinguished panel on my left, who I will introduce as we come to each of their contributions, and then it will be open for discussion and contributions, questions from the floor, to which our panel will respond. And last but not least, there is a reception to follow, where I hope many of the conversations that we begin during the formal part of the evening can continue more informally over a glass of wine. So to start, Liz Sayce has recently completed a Joseph Rowntree Foundation research fellowship in practice here at the LSE's International Inequalities Institute. She was previously, as you know, Chief Executive of Disability Rights UK, and she's going to introduce the report. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you very much, Tanya, and just a few other thank yous. So we're launching this evening a report. There's a summary report, which many of you have in your hands. There's also an easy read version, which I've just put up a picture of, and there's also a pretty long report that is just online if you really want to delve into the detail, but no obligation. And I'd like to thank, a lot of people who've fed into this work, really, lots of people in this room and others, a lot of disabled people, disabled people's organisations and employers and others, and particular thanks to the International Inequalities Institute for great support, and also to Joseph Rowntree Foundation for supporting this work, and Chris Golden is here, so a huge thank you to you. Right, okay. I started out by thinking, employment and disabled people has become a really sort of contested topic. So people like me have been pushing for years for rights to work. But increasingly, we were being challenged by newer campaigners who were kind of saying, no, you're, to put it most bluntly, you're colluding with the government's aim to cut the benefits bill. You mustn't keep pushing this employment agenda. This is all about pressure to work. And some people started saying, actually, what we need is the right not to work. And we're too sick to work. You must stop pressurising us. But then people who were making that argument got challenged in turn for saying, talking about being too sick to work is like turning the clock back and saying, kind of, we're victims, we're emphasising what we can't do, and we're throwing the baby of equality out with the bathwater, if you like, of restrictive benefits and so on. At the same time, we have a policy goal that's about more disabled people in jobs. You know, at the moment, it's 1 million more disabled people working by 2027. People object to that because, and Tanya's just mentioned it, because we've had so long of the sort of supply side approaches, great big support programs from Pathways to Work to the Work Programme, benefit incentives and disincentives, but what's happened, we've still got a disability employment gap of 30%, and the pay gap, according to the TUC, has increased slightly to around 15%. It seemed to me that possibly, if we could address some of the objections, particularly to that policy goal, we might be able to create a positive agenda that people might, this is optimism, be able to unite over. And that's what I really wanted to try to do. It did seem to me that there was evidence that there was an unfair allocation of responsibilities between the individual disabled person, the state, the employer. And just to give one example, if you look at who gets, so to speak, sanctioned or punished for not meeting their requirements, for disabled people in 15-16, it was about 70,000 times that people got sanctioned and got benefit reductions for not complying with requirements, whereas for employers, it was about 1,100, so more than 60 times as often. That didn't seem to sort of resonate with the truth of the kinds of barriers that exist in employment around the country. So we wanted to forge a positive agenda based on what disabled people really want and require, but working with employers, working with policy experts, and very much honouring earlier work. I mean, I know Sue is here from Disability Rights UK. There's been work by all sorts of organisations that have come before this, and I've aimed to sort of build on that. And I think what's come out of the sessions I've run with people as part of this project is what people want is not just more disabled people in jobs, any jobs. As one person put it, we need to get rid of this idea we should be grateful for being offered a job at all. So we need to reduce pay gaps as well as employment gaps. And we need work that's genuinely inclusive and flexible. So, for example, if you have an energy-reducing impairment, that means perhaps you can work for a certain number of hours per week, what would it take for employers to chunk up the roles so that you could do this chunk of the role in your X number of hours a week, perhaps flexibly when you can do it? And rather than employers just sort of saying, oh, this is the job, this is the way the job's always been organised, so we'll just advertise it again in the same way, really rethinking jobs, which is going beyond what a lot of employers think of as reasonable. So I was looking really for a new balance of responsibilities of citizenship, if you like. I'll come back to this in a minute, but some new responsibilities for the state, not just things like requiring transparent reporting, but also helping particularly small employers more effectively and leading by example. And for employers, their own leadership internally, but also being accountable to shareholders and to stakeholders. And then for individuals, really being able to find substantive opportunities. So it's not just you've got to try and find a job as things are, but there are going to be more real opportunities for people across different impairments. And communities could be praising the good employers, challenging those that have got a long way to go. Okay, but what could actually work? And as one business leader put it to me, targeting employers' attitudes is a dead end. What's important is behaviour. And I think we've had a lot of sort of voluntary schemes and voluntary standards and encouragement. And the theory seems to be that if you encourage employers to change their attitudes, then as night follows day, their behaviour will change. I think there's a lot of good evidence and theory that suggests that actually the opposite is true. Contact theory suggests that it's real-life contact. It's things like inclusive education. It's having disabled bosses and disabled colleagues. That's what changes both attitudes and behaviour in a virtuous circle. To get you started on that virtuous circle, you need to influence behaviour. And to do that, you need the exercise of power. That doesn't necessarily mean big sticks. It's the power inside an organisation of somebody on the board taking this really seriously and driving it, the intrinsic power. But it's also extrinsic power of regulation, of campaigns, of accountability for shareholders and so on. And there's still, let's not forget, discrimination. It may not be deliberate, but there's a disability employment penalty. You earn less as a disabled graduate than as a non-disabled graduate. That can't be right. So what I did was set up some criteria to select proposals, because as one person said, I'm fed up with waiting for the change to happen. We need to identify a few things, a few big things that as a set will really make a difference. Otherwise, we'll just have a long list and we'll go on and on. One of the criteria was valued substantive opportunities that disabled people view as that. And using that criterion, some ideas dropped away. For example, quotas. So if there's any fans of quotas in the room, do say in the discussion. But on the whole, people didn't really want them. Same with employer subsidies. Another criterion was it's got to be feasible in the given the nature of the future of work. And what I wanted was short and long-term proposals that would work together. So for example, if you strengthen the requirement on an employer to retain someone who acquires a health condition or an impairment, that could put them off taking on somebody who's known to have a health condition, because they think, well, I'll never be able to get rid of them. So there is something in here about strengthening those requirements, but it's balanced by help and incentivization at the point of hiring. So if an employer takes somebody on with a health condition, actually some of the risks and costs are offset under this wonderful schema, which I realise is, it's a set of propositions. So, proposition number one, transparency. I was really interested to hear the chief executive of Unilever this year saying, I think government needs to be a bit stricter with us. Why are the requirements to report on gender but not on disability? Well, very good question. I think there's been a bit of a sea change. The CBI has been welcoming reporting on the basis of ethnicity and disability on pay. So I'm suggesting here, and I know government has recently urged large employers to collect data, publish it transparently, but I would like to see them require large employers, just as they do on gender, and to require them to with proper good time for testing and guidance and everything, but require them to publish on employment and pay, and a few other things. And also, I'd like to see sectors and big organisations consider setting targets. Now, the broadcasting sector has set some ambitious targets, and I'm looking at Graham Whitley, I think there may be other people here from the broadcasting sector, and it's going to be really interesting to see, but we've already seen in organisations like Channel 4 an increase. So, targets can work, and they've worked in the United States as well. I'm going to carry on, sorry, just because I'm conscious of time. I'm hoping that some of our other speakers are going to talk about things like what we've learned from gender pay gap reporting and how it can really act as a stimulus for competition between employers and accountability and really drive change. Some people said, oh yes, but you can't really introduce this required transparency. People would just make up the numbers. And so I found an example of where somebody did make up the numbers in Japan. They confessed to it. However, they were caught. And I don't think the fact that somebody does something they shouldn't have done is a good enough reason for not saying it should. I mean, lots of people do things they shouldn't have done. The trick is to have ways of checking on whether that's happening or not. I don't think that's a good enough reason not to do it. Right. Number two, risk sharing. So this is about government being more helpful to employers, particularly small employers. First of all, each person with a fluctuating condition could have in the bank, so to speak, an agreed sum that can be mobilised quickly if they become unwell and unable to work for a period, so the employer doesn't lose out. This has been recommended before, but anyway, no harm in recommending it again. In addition to that proposition, which I think would really remove a big disincentive for employers taking somebody on in that situation, a fund for small employers to make whole small businesses really inclusive, their internal processes, their online, everything, because it's difficult for small employers to do it. And we did look at other things like tax incentives, but people thought what we want to incentivize is whole inclusion, not paying the employer, so to speak, to employ a disabled person. Wrong message, that's a deficit model. access to work targets to match the proposed increases. So if we're going to have a million more disabled people in work by 2027, how many of them are going to need access to work? So let's set some targets. And statutory sick pay, government paying statutory sick pay in specified circumstances, somebody's coming off employment and support allowance, or it's equivalent under universal credit. I must apologise for talking fast. I just want to get through this so you can hear other people's thoughts, which are really important. Rights. Okay. I've just been in the United States, where I discovered that 72% of CVs, according to research in America, are rejected before any human being reviews them. The algorithms screen people out, not only on the basis of things like gaps on the CV, but also on the basis of facial movement and voice. So if you don't speak to your algorithm nicely and you don't make eye contact with your robotic whatnot, you can be screened out before any human has seen you. This is clearly potentially very discriminatory. So I have a suggestion that David might like to respond to, that perhaps the EHRC or the Commission in Northern Ireland could consider having a look at that, because I think these emerging issues, new forms of discrimination, we need to nail them before they get going, really. I think there's also some ways of strengthening the legal framework, and I had some really good discussions with Cathy Kessley, who's also here, about some of this. For example, reinstating the tribunal power to order wider changes where a case reveals systemic discrimination, and strengthening the public sector equality duty. These don't all need primary legislation. Some of them could be done by other means. And just perhaps a plug for people need to know their rights, and Disability Rights UK's Right to Participate platform is one way people can share stories, learn how to challenge, and so on. Leadership, right. Both employers and those businesses that contract people, the so-called app workers, need to engage with their disabled workers, trade unions, in order to co-produce practices that will lead to inclusive work and will reduce the gaps. But I'm also suggesting that local authorities and combined authorities could bring together at local level the employers, health services, care, educationalists, disabled people's organisations to work together on how you meet the labour shortages and the skills shortages that so many employers are facing, including, of course, the health service and the social care sector. So they would be there both as employers and as people in touch with disabled people who know how to support them to get work. So various people in the audience I can see who've done a lot of work on supporting people with mental health problems to work, for example. So the NHS is doing both, isn't it? Supporting people to work and it's employing people. And I think at local level people could come up with some really good stuff. Government needs to align its policies across government. That's a pretty obvious truism. But also short term, align outcomes wherever possible. For example, could Job Centre Plus be measured not on how many people get off benefits or into work, but how many people get into work who are still in work sometime later and who are in work in which they develop and they progress in their careers? Because that fits with universal credit and it fits with disabled people's aspirations. Okay, so finally, alliances for action. I'm out of time. So I started by saying this was a contested topic. And I think we could create a platform on which people could unite with a positive aim. And it's always better to say what you want than just what you don't want in terms of success. And I think we need to join up. And I've had a number of interesting conversations with people in this room and others about this. But first of all, different impairment organisations operating in silos. As one person said, employers are exhausted by the enthusiasm of the sector which isn't joined up. And also, disabled people's organisations and charities don't join up because they disagree. And it's just a quote I like here. Outsiders often think the insiders are sellouts who muddy the waters through compromise or hijack their issues, while insiders often view outsiders as politically naive purists but recognise that the threat they pose often drives decision makers into their arms. So there's all those dynamics, and then people don't work together. So we need to come together across differences of impairment, and when there's a common aim, from time to time, activists and big charities can work together on this. It doesn't mean you have to be united all the time. And allying with others with similar aims. I mean, the flexible work agenda, it's mainly about parents, but I've had some great contacts with people saying, oh yes, let's bring in disability into this as well and really make it holistic. All the people who are working for a living wage, for freedom, you know, solving UK poverty, to quote Dirty Roundtree Foundation, and of course alliances with the people who can make change happen. And just to end, I mean, I remember when I first got involved with Stonewall in the 1990s, the idea that you would get equal marriage in the timescale that we got it was utterly, utterly unthinkable. It really was unthinkable. So I think the thing is that if you could create positive aims, people galvanise behind them and they're more likely to happen. So just a bit of a plea, so if we could come together. These might, you know, we could debate what the aims should be, but I think we should have some positive ones. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Liz. There's a lot of food for thought in that. But giving you time to assemble your thoughts in the audience, I turn first to my left here. I'm very pleased to introduce David Isaac, who's chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, previously chair of Stonewall, and a partner in the law firm Pinsent Masons.
David. Thank you very much. And I'm delighted to be here this evening, and I think anybody who knows Liz will not be surprised that she's produced a really important series of recommendations, but I think more importantly, a series of really intelligent and thoughtful recommendations, which I would certainly urge you to read very carefully, and also in relation to the alliance that Liz was just talking about, that we together come to look at the detail, but also to mobilize as well, because I'd completely endorse what Liz is saying about how together we can really drive change. And I'm particularly pleased to be here to speak on behalf of the EHRC, because obviously the role of the regulator in relation to our dialogue with government, holding government to account, but working with employers and individuals and communities is incredibly important. And to be very clear, I'm very keen to use the carrot where we can, but also to use the stick when it's necessary. So you might imagine that as chair of the EHRC, I'm really in favour of increased inclusion of disabled people in the workplace. But this is not an issue that should only be an issue of importance for disability groups and equality bodies. This is everybody's issue. And when I speak on these sorts of platforms, I'm always really disappointed that we only speak to audiences that vehemently agree with us. And it's really important. I've just come back from Geneva at the UN, where we were talking about the importance of human rights and employers. And there again, I made exactly the same point, because there were loads and loads of people who, of course, agreed with everything that we should say. And sadly, there were very few employers there. There were some. And they were the ones who were boasting, and I use that word advisedly, in relation to the great progress that they're making. But there weren't enough employers who were not making progress who were there to listen to what was being said in the various recommendations. Tanya made the point very early on about the changing nature of the workforce, and I won't repeat the stats because I'm sure I haven't got time in relation to how disabled people are really not integrated into the workforce. You might know that the EHRC every 3 years is required to produce a snapshot of Britain, and we look particularly at equalities and human rights and focus on the lived experience of protected groups. The good news is that we have actually reported recently that there has been progress in relation to education, and there are more women now in the workplace. But sadly, in relation to disabled people, things continue to be bad, and in some cases, particularly I think in relation to employment, things are getting worse. And that just is not acceptable. So we know that even if disabled people are in work, there are likely to be challenges in relation to the fact that you're going to be lower paid, you'll be working part-time, and you'll be in lower skilled employment. And what we therefore know is that if there's going to be change, the sorts of recommendations that Liz is making in the report absolutely need to be adopted. This isn't just the right thing to do. I think it's the smart thing to do, because we do need to shake up the status quo and we need to drive change. So there are two recommendations that Liz has mentioned that I particularly want to focus on, given the EHRC's role. The first one is obviously transparency, because like Liz, we're actually suggesting that there are huge lessons to be learned from the fact that as the regulator of the gender pay gap, there are lots and lots of things that can be applied to disabled people in the workforce. And so we do agree with Liz's recommendation that there should be greater transparency and improved data collection. So what we've seen in relation to the gender pay gap reporting is that we've had 100% compliance in relation to the reporting of the information. And as a regulator, that's obviously great news. But actually, what we've seen is that there's a huge amount of attention on the pay gaps themselves, and also how various employers, particularly the big employers, are compared one against the other. And actually, what we're more concerned about is actually how we drive systemic change and use the national debate that has focused around gender pay gap to drive change in all areas of the workforce. So what we are particularly doing is looking at the information that employers voluntarily produce alongside the compulsory pay gap reporting in relation to gender. Now, the depressing thing is that there are lots and lots of generic statements about how employers want to improve, and there are lots and lots of generic statements about the systemic reasons, like the fact that, for example, there aren't enough women studying STEM subjects. We think that obviously that's an important factor, but actually what we're looking for is tangible action and real commitment in terms of action plans to drive change. Blaming systemic causes and actually not taking responsibility as employers is not really going to result in any change. Although the point that Liz made earlier in relation to how the national debate has actually caused employers to be fearful about their gender pay gaps is quite interesting. So I've heard, for example, that headhunters are actually targeting employers and women, senior women in particular, who work for employers with very large pay gaps. Those organizations are going to lose their best talent. And that's something that we need to ensure applies to all areas where there is pay gap reporting. So like Liz, we actually support the call for compulsory pay gap reporting in relation to disability pay gaps. We think that that should be implemented with organizations or by organizations with over 250 staff by 2020 at the latest. And we think that the information that should be provided should also include information relating to retention and progression of disabled people. We think that that will drive huge change. But what we know is that there are only 3% of employers who already can report on disability pay gaps within their organization. So there's a huge amount of work that will need to be done to educate employers, but also to prepare them for the huge exercise of providing this information. That, in our view, is not a good enough reason to delay it or not to do it at all. What we know is that huge amounts of change will come about as a result. Employers are obviously terribly concerned about the increased bureaucracy that could result, but our view is that no viable employer ever dreams about operating without using a range of different data, whether it's in relation to their marketplace, their competitors, or their customers. So why shouldn't employers do it in relation to their employees? It's a common sense approach that needs to be applied to all aspects of the composition of our work forces. So we encourage business not to wait until government introduces the requirement and makes it absolutely compulsory, because I think government will. It needs to be something that happens immediately. This is an example where employers can be exemplary in the way in which they introduce best practice, and I think there will be plaudits for employers who do more sooner. Two very quick points, and Liz alluded to them. Increased flexibility in work is absolutely vital. It will empower disabled people to get into the workplace, but work flexibly, but also acknowledging their particular conditions. And I think, I've alluded to it already, training for employers is absolutely vital, because with training, and there's lots and lots of materials around, employers will have no excuse not to make the sort of progress that is necessary. The EHRC has got lots of guidance, and in fact, next year, early in 2019, we're going to be publishing a guide for line managers, because actually this isn't just an issue where the board needs to talk about things. Individual line managers need to be trained to understand the particular issues, to be creative, picking up on some of the things that Liz has mentioned in relation to individual disabled people and how they can be accommodated into the workplace. Very quickly then, I wanted to pick up Liz's other recommendation, which is about enforcement. And you won't be surprised, because I'm really keen, as I mentioned, in relation to the stick. I will be really quick.
Two minutes.
I've got 2 minutes. We want to increase the power of authorities under the PSED. We also want to ensure that the EHRC continues to play its role. So since I've been chair, we've been able to do 50% more using our enforcement powers than we did previously. So we're bringing more inquiries. I hope you've seen that we've been holding the Premier League to account in relation to their shocking approach towards inaccessible stadia, and there are now 700 more wheelchair spaces than there were previously. But also, Liz, in her report, is suggesting that the responsibility for these things shouldn't sit with the individuals. I believe that's correct, but I do think individuals have a particular role to play if they're brave and if we support them in a strategically important case. So Doug Pawley's case is one that we supported, which I think is incredibly important in terms of buses. And Tani and I are already talking about how we can shine the spotlight on transport and trains in particular. We're hoping that in the new year we'll make more progress. Please look at the new draft strategic plan for the EHRC, because that is an area that's really important, as is algorithms and technology. So I'll wrap up now by saying that Liz's report is incredibly important. It's a platform where we all need to support one another to mobilize, because even though we are in an echo chamber this evening, what we all care about is to ensure that disabled people get into the workplace and are no longer treated as second-class citizens. However, only by taking the message outside will we actually translate that into practice. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and good evening, everybody. I didn't realise the last comment there kindly made from Tanya about gold medals in swimming. I didn't realise we were going to have a history lesson tonight as well. That all happened when television was still black and white. But much, much less of that now. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I had no hesitation when Liz kindly invited me, because I'm sure none of us in this room are in any doubt. Nobody has done more alongside disabled people to achieve change and impact than Liz has. And tonight is yet another stellar example of not just the work that Liz does, but the thought and the rigour and the collaboration and the connection which goes behind that work. So absolutely delighted to be here and support the work. I do have to say, there is one person in the room who is even slightly more talented than Liz, and that is the fabulous BSL interpreter who manages to keep up when Liz is in full flight. It's more than a canter. So what I want to do in a few moments, that's probably the minister already agreeing Liz's report, I think, on the phone now. It's funny how things have changed as well, isn't it, in public, that it's only a few years ago that all you would hear constantly in environments like this and on the tube and trains would be the Nokia Sonic tag. Gone completely now. Now it's always the Apple tag. It's a fascinating thing. That shows, again, change over a very short period of time. What I thought I'd like to do tonight is just talk about a couple of the areas that I'm involved with and not to detain you any longer than that. And the start point really is a question that I would put to any organisation, private, public, third, whatever. And that really is, how many disabled people are employed, are members, are part of your organisation? The only real answer that that organisation, barring a few, could honestly give you is, haven't really got a clue, mate. Haven't got a clue. Lots of reasons for that, but two I think worth focusing on, and Liz has already eloquently touched on this. Firstly, data. The way that we go about collecting this data, how it's set out, how the questions asked, all of that incredibly significant in terms of how that is captured. And if we believe, as I do, that there's a real opportunity from the fourth industrial revolution, for not least disabled people, in that for so many years, on so many issues, we've been on the wrong end of that thin wedge. If I believe there is that opportunity from the fourth industrial revolution, opportunity, not inevitability, then it will all be predicated on the data. Data which all too often, inside almost all organisations, in truth, is incomplete, inconsistent, non-existent. So how can we hope to gain the advantages of the fourth industrial revolution? How can we hope to have change at the pace it otherwise could be? How can we hope to get the best possible outcomes for all people if we don't have that data? Secondly, the culture. Again, how many disabled people are in your organisation? If the culture isn't truly inclusive, and that's not an end point, that is a constant dynamic. We never get to the end point of that journey, but if we're not all constantly striving to create that dynamic, inclusive culture, you really won't be able to say how many disabled people you have in your organisation, because who is necessarily going to say that if it's not seen as just not a thing of itself, neither positive nor negative, just a thing, because it's an inclusive organisation. Hence, I was delighted to be involved with Channel 4. Even before getting onto the board, I was involved with the Year of Disability, and fabulous that Graham Whippy's here, who's also part of that. Mainly, I was glad to be part of it because I got to chair an organisation within it called the Year of Disability Advisors, which made me chair of YODA. That's real power. And why I was specifically delighted to be part of that work and to chair that group was not only because of the totality of it, but if I were to pick one thing from it, what we were able to demonstrate, and you'll be utterly unsurprised that Liz was absolutely right at the centre of that committee as well that we put together, what we demonstrated more than anything was that change doesn't need to take a generation or generations. As Liz said, with equal marriage, who would have thought? Actually, change can happen in a relatively short space of time if the will is there, if we understand the elements and everything is put in place and there's leadership, innovation and that cultural dimension put in it. And this was part of the Year of Disability, through a relatively straightforward approach, not least tying into the essence of the organisation, using the power of film, self-made films by many people across the organisation, it would make sense for broadcasters to do that, where people just told their own story in their own words. And through that, we took the levels of self-declaration by disabled people in the organisation from 3% to 11.5%. Now, organisations, as David quite rightly said, are probably already starting to feel a little bit nervous about potential disability pay gap reporting. Now, wouldn't it be smart if, as a start point, they thought into this and thought, well, we're already absolutely some way further down the track than we even know on this, if we just enable that culture and put everything in there. So the people who are already in our organisation feel absolutely liberated to be themselves at work. And even if, and this is a very small even if an organisation and employer only wanted to do it for purely balance sheet reasons, and it's a universe, it's a galaxy more reasons than that, but even if you're doing it just on the hard numbers, why would you choose to employ somebody and pay them 100% of their salary, but because they can't be 100% themselves at work, only get 70, 50, 30, whatever percentage off it? It makes no sense. And that's only one tiny part of it, is the numbers. So change absolutely can happen, not necessarily in a generation, but in a short space of time, if there's the will, the leadership, the culture, and the commitment, and the work gets done. Why also I got involved with this review on public appointments, which is being published next Monday, just to pick a day completely at random, obviously. And again, I hope that the recommendations which come from that review will chime with you all. The truth is, as we all know, there's no magic to any of this, nor do we need magic solutions. But there is certainly a need to absolutely nail the basics. And if you have that as a start point, then things which seem magical can come through as a result of that. I hope that there'll be many recommendations when you see the report next Monday, which have absolute specific applicability for disabled people, but also speak much broader, not just across all protected characteristics, not just across public appointments, but across the whole gamut of recruitment and society. Because ultimately, in conclusion, there is a whole road of complexity, of detail about all of these issues. But ultimately, it is pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward. All we're talking about here is talent. Addressing that truth, that utterly avoidable failing in our society still, that talent is everywhere, opportunity is not. Not least all that talent in fabulous talented disabled people up and down the country. And I think it's, you all know in this room, it's all of our mission. But as David quite rightly said, it's to engage every single person. That all of these issues, not just the issues around disability, but the issues around inclusion, around fairness, around dignity, about respect, these are issues for every single person in this country and beyond, rippling around the world. Delighted to be here again. Sincere congratulations to Liz on another excellent, thoughtful, and absolutely will be incredibly impactful piece of work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Chris. So I introduce now our final speaker, Baroness Tanny Gray-Thompson, a crossbench peer. She's frequently spoken on in the Lords on disability rights and welfare reform. She holds a number of board positions, and I suppose in all fairness I should also mention that Tanny's got a few gold medals to her name as well.
Thank you very much. And if Chris was competing when it was black and white, I don't know when I was competing, but anyway. Thank you, Tanya and Liz, for inviting me here tonight. And I also should start off by apologising to the sign language interpreter, because I'm Welsh, so I talk really quickly. So I have once had a sign language interpreter come up to me and just go, "Stop!" Yeah. So I shall watch out for the hand signals. And the challenge of going third, most of the sensible stuff has been said, so it's... So I'm going to have a bit of a rant, actually. First of all, actually, before I start ranting, is thanks to Liz in so many different ways, not just for this report, but when I was working on welfare reform and legal aid in the Lords, which were gifts that kept giving. It's the only way you can talk about those two bits of legislation. The quiet counsel that she provided all the way through in terms of making sure that I wasn't completely outrageous in the chamber and got chucked out was a huge help to me. And I think that's carried on in terms of, if you look at the recommendations and the proposals going forward, the fact that they're so sensible makes it really hard for people to argue with them. But it's what we do now in terms of making a real change. Chris didn't talk about his work that he did with 2012, so I'm going to do it for him. If you look at companies and businesses that are truly diverse, as the organising committee for 2012 was, it shows you what incredible things can happen. A diverse range of people working in the building produced diverse volunteers, it flogged loads of tickets, and it made the Paralympic Games a huge success. One of my frustrations is 2012 didn't change the world for disabled people, and if another non-disabled person tells me that, I might just slap them. Because we don't get lots of non-disabled men standing up saying, well, 2012 changed the world for women, because quite frankly it didn't. 2012 was an amazing sporting moment, and it was incredible. But we have to do more than look backwards. We have to look forwards to see what change we can really bring about. And I generally thought by the time I got to the age I am now, I wouldn't still be talking about the things that I was whittling on about 30 years ago. And I did wonder whether the quote in there about being bored was from me, because I am a bit bored with having to keep talking about some of these things. And the pay gap has been incredible, talking about women's pay gap. I would love to look at the intersectionality of that. That's maybe a little bit further down the line if we're still nowhere near looking at reporting on the disability pay gap. But if we don't keep pushing for these things, change is not going to come about. And I was talking to an employer recently. It's not a huge business, but they were busily telling me how wonderful they employ disabled people. So I started trying to dig a bit deeper, saying, what sort of impairments? And they said, we had that woman who broke her leg and used a wheelchair for 6 weeks. Okay, yeah, well done. But let's have a little bit more of a think about it than that. And I think, when we look about culture, there's still a lot we need to do. I can't really hide my impairment. It's fairly obvious. But around people with fluctuating conditions and hidden impairments, excuse me, really feeling able within the work environment to declare and come forward. We're nowhere near there as we need to be. And the reality is we're missing out on a hugely important group of people who can contribute to businesses and societies in lots of different ways. And the bit where I'm bored of, I'm a bit bored of, just saying, let's get disabled people through the door. Okay, yeah, that's great. But actually, it's about showing genuine career progression. It's about getting disabled people onto boards, to be CEOs, to be chairs, prime minister. I'm not putting my name forward.
Could be a vacancy.
And moving swiftly on. but until we get disabled people genuinely across all aspects of society, we're not going to bring about the change that we want. And, a career in sport is great. We too can speak for that, but that's not realistic for a whole bunch of people. And one of the things I really worry about at the moment is the only options a lot of young disabled people are being given is be a Paralympian, and actually you kind of need to be good at sport to do that. We don't, this is where I'm going to have a rant, okay? We don't say to every non-disabled child, oh yes, be an Olympian. I know you can't play any sport and you want to play basketball but you're 5 foot tall, but go for it. I'd love to change some of those things. And this is about opening up disabled people's minds themselves to thinking and really pushing them to see what they they can possibly achieve. And apologies to anyone who follows me on Twitter for the amount I'm tweeting about public transport at the moment. I'm having a great time. I am loving it. Lots of train companies aren't quite so happy to be in communication with me. I had one recently who direct messaged me and told me, could I stop tweeting because I was undermining their work? I included them in every tweet for the next 48 hours. But unless we change some of that as well, and, you know, some of these big companies, it's not just how they treat disabled people. One of the questions I'm going to be going on to all the train operating companies and asking is, how many disabled people do you employ, actually? Because, you know, they can do an awful lot better than they're currently doing. And when we think about, you know, the flexibility around work, the world is changing. The world will change faster in the next 5 years than it has in the last 20 with technology, changes in economic circumstance, Brexit, whatever that's going to bring. As a country, we need to be sort of more fleet of foot in terms of getting the best out of people. And lots of companies talk about bringing the whole self to work, but I've not seen that really come across into thinking about how we can enable disabled people to work smartly. One of the other challenges, which Liz touched on, was thinking about creative industries and people being self-employed, and that's being pushed as a way forward for disabled people. I would sort of say you kind of need a PhD to understand access to work and some of the other benefit systems. but you know, there has to be ways of making that better and more flexible. And because I do think that is a massive, huge opportunity to get disabled people into work, but you know, it's not there yet. And actually, what I was really excited over the weekend. I went to my local supermarket and on the checkout, I saw a young man who was hemiplegic, had cerebral palsy, and I got really excited because I saw him working behind the till. Until my 16-year-old daughter said, like, what are you getting excited for? I was like, it's a disabled person. And she was like, yeah, well, yeah. And that's because she's used to being around lots of disabled people. But we shouldn't be in a world, I shouldn't be in a world where I'm excited because I see a disabled person in a job. I really shouldn't. And she was very good at putting me back into my box, as only 16-year-old daughters can. You know, we've got disability confident, and it's okay, it's fine. It's a step forward. I don't see it solving all the problems of the world. I know some companies have it as a lovely logo on the website. My favourite question to all of them is, what do you actually do to get more disabled people? You know, saying you have an accessible toilet is not enough. And I would like to see that kind of the carrot and the stick to really push employers to think about what they can do to genuinely have more disabled people at every single level. And then the final thing really is, you know, actually, you know, we all need to work together to bring improvements, but I think we need to turn the spotlight on ourselves and say, you know, actually, are we doing everything we can to give opportunities to disabled people? The charities and the organisations that I work with, you know, do they genuinely have enough disabled people working for them and in them? And that's an important question that I think we need to answer. But actually, even though I'm quite grumpy about some of this, ultimately, I'm really positive. Because actually, at least now we're talking about some of these things in a way that certainly I haven't for a little while. And what I hope comes out of this is helping disabled people realise that they can be more demanding. They don't have to settle for second best. They can and they should be in work. And we need to really push hard on that. And the final thing I want to say is again, just thank you to Liz. You know, this document is really helpful, really important. I'll be quoting it in the House of Lords. And it just will be really helpful in the ongoing work that I'm doing. So thank you so much for that. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to all our speakers. You've been very patient. Your turn to share your thoughts, ask questions, make comments. If you raise a hand or otherwise indicate, and if you'd start by saying who you are, that would be very helpful. Yes, here on my right.
Hi, I'm James Lee from the City Bridge Trust. I just wanted to thank the panel and echo your thoughts on data and transparency in particular. I think it's really important. The old saying, what gets measured gets managed, is absolutely true. And it's why things like the recently published voluntary reporting framework are a really powerful first step in the right direction. I wondered what the panel's thoughts are on leveraging some of that data with the carrot masquerading as stick, or is it stick masquerading as carrot, known as the Social Value Act?
Hi, I'm Sue Bott from Disability Rights UK. I want to raise the support that disabled people get. Following on from Tanya's comments about us disabled people feeling confident in ourselves and going out and demanding the best, I think that that really means that we have to have the support that we need to lead our daily lives, because I think the problem at the moment is that many of us disabled people are so struggling to just get by every day, and I don't mean financially, I mean being able to keep body and soul together, because your support needs are being met, that it's very difficult to concentrate on anything else. Unfortunately, I think that the government has this attitude that any money that's spent on disabled people and our support, they wish it wasn't. And I think that they don't think through the benefits. And I'm minded, actually, when I was doing my master's in public service a few moons ago, wasn't black and white telly, but it's a bit more recent than that, but I read a report from the OECD, and it's stuck with me ever since. And that report really questioned why, when people lose their jobs, that the next day they're absolutely plunged into poverty, whereas actually the exact opposite should happen, because all the evidence is that if people are able to keep body and soul together and are wherewithal and everything, then they can get back into work. And I think similarly with disabled people, if we're not getting that joined up support, and I think it does need to be joined up, that keeps us in our homes, that keeps us living a decent life, then unfortunately I think the employment gap will persist.
Hello, I'm Deborah Williams, the CEO of the Creative Diversity Network. Two things. One is the whole self-to-work thing is quite challenging if you're not white. And I think, and I would encourage you to have an understanding of that when you say it, because being a black person and whole self-to-work means that you're usually, there's lots of grievances that are brought against you because of your alleged behavior. And I would invert comment, but I don't have enough hands and I'm holding a mic, so I would do inverted commas, but I can't. And that's something that I experience a lot as a black person, have done. And secondly, as a disabled CEO, which I am, but no one acknowledges or recognizes, which is really interesting, especially in the creative industries, I think I'd also like to say that when we invite non-disabled people into our spaces and the operators, our supporters, I think I'd encourage non-disabled people to not bully us and to not undermine us and not terrorize us in our spaces, because actually we're supposed to be supporting each other. And I think that's something that happens a lot in terms of work, in terms of employment, is that if you're a disabled person leading an organization and non-disabled people are working with or alongside you, when you're not doing it right, again in inverted commas, you're sort of they feel comfortable and confident in challenging you and what you're doing, and using their non-disabled status as a reason for people to pay more attention to them than to you. And thirdly, we have a project called Doubling Disability. I don't know if Liz did mention it which I would I'd like Chris and Tanny to support, please. It's Creative Industries. Chris, Channel 4 know all about it. If they don't, I can tell you all about it because Dan Brook is on my board. So he should have told you about it. If he hasn't, let me know and I'll chat with him about that. And Tanny, I'll drop you a note because it's a massive project. It's covering access to work, DWP is supporting, and all sorts of stuff going on. So it's about change. Anyway, thanks.
Good evening. My name is David Buxton. I'm the Chief Executive of Action on Disability. Obviously, you are hearing my voice through a female interpreter. So I'm hoping that that shows we have a good diverse workforce. Joking aside, I have two questions for the panel. Firstly, how do you define disability data? I've struggled with many companies to say, you know, they have data. For example, we have someone with a hearing loss in one ear, and that doesn't necessarily get counted as disability data. Then they will say we are a disabled people's employer, and I think we need to think quite clearly about what disability data means, which means that, you know, there is no access, there are barriers, there is not inclusivity. That is actually a definition of possibly the disability data that we need to collect in order to champion our cause. The second question is about leadership, as Liz has spoken about. My biggest concern is if you're talking about employment and the employment gap and reducing that employment gap, non-disabled people make decisions about what happens in our future. And where is that co-production? Because they don't talk to us. They don't talk to us about positive action. So this report should have more disability involvement in terms of that. I think that's frustrating for me because, and I would like to ask the panel what changes they think will happen as a result of the publication of the report.
Lots of other people, but I want to just pause there to give the panel a chance to respond to some of those points. So we've had the question of the stick macerating of a carrot, we've had contribution drawing our attention to the support that disabled people need with daily living. They can start thinking about jobs. We've had a comment about non-disabled people potentially being a barrier within workplaces through bullying and so forth. And then we've had the questions most recently from David about disability data and leadership. So Liz, do you want to?
Yeah. Can people hear me without a mic or I'll stand up? Okay, so yes, on data and the Social Value Act. Yes, there is actually, I didn't really dwell on it, but there is something in this report about using procurement and the leverage of funding more broadly, actually grant funding and so on as well. I mean, Philip Connolly is here, who's done a lot of work on this in terms of procurement in relation to driving change in terms of employment of disabled people, so he might want to say something in a minute. But I think, I mean, amongst other things I've said in this report are that funders of whatever kind, if, for example, if they're funding disability organisations, they should think, are those disability organisations actually employing disabled people at all levels? That would be a useful kind of check. But more broadly, putting social value measures into tender scores matters and can make a difference. On Sue's point about support and daily living, I think we've got into a very sort of narrow debate about social care, which is all about funding that people need to be looked after. And there's a great blog space called Social Care Futures, which is really trying to identify a better narrative about what we want. But I think it's beyond social care, really. It's social care, it's health care, it's your activity, it's the support you need to work, it's the support you need to study. It's all of those things. And wouldn't it be great if we had a sort of coherent approach to investment in the support people need across their lives, so that it was seamless and you didn't have all these different bureaucracies that you had to grapple with. And maybe shall I leave it there and let others answer other questions? Oh, just can I just say to Deborah, though, because I so agree with you. One of the things I've suggested about the intersectionality, to coin the jargon, but one of the things I'd suggested was a dashboard employers could use that looks across the experiences of ethnicity, disability, gender, and so on. That we don't just do gender and then we move on to disability, that we really do think about it much more holistically. And I think the work that you're doing on doubling disability and the measurement and all everything that sits behind that initiative are really, really useful to people. I very strongly sort of suggest people have a look at that initiative because it's really important.
I lost a philosophical argument about 1 o'clock in the morning in the welfare reform bill, which was about if we're giving people money, what could we ask of them? And, you know, so everyone had a minimum, but, you know, you were just sort of challenging people to do different things. So, yes, they could volunteer and they could, you know, work part-time. And actually, it got nowhere because it doesn't fit into a nice box of assessment process. You know, I'd argue that some of the welfare reform forms haven't... anyway, saved anywhere near as enough of the money that they were meant to, and actually we've just got a system that's quite complicated, and no doubt we're going to come back to it again, but I think we have to take a whole different approach. I think, as Liz says, you know, it's health and social care, it's education, it's provision of wheelchairs, you know, that is a complete postcode lottery in this country. Prosthetics, still a postcode lottery, and, you know, I don't think that's good enough. Dublin disability, I'm aware of it, it's great. I didn't say, but I sat on the board of the BBC, and I know Tony Hall supported it, and the BBC has just released a disability career progression report, which has made a number of recommendations in terms of not just getting more people in, but also about how we can help them progress upwards, because again, you know, it's... I think the on-screen stuff is really... You know, so growing up, my only representation... I didn't meet another disabled person until I was 10, and the only disabled people I saw were Sandy Richardson on Crossroads and Ironside, you know. And seriously, so... Is that really dead? But it wasn't great. You know, I didn't see anyone else who looked like me. It really wasn't. But actually, the people I saw who looked like me weren't me at all. So, you know, I just think, you know, there's absolutely something about on-screen and genuine diversity, but it's also got to be behind the screens as well. And... We talked about definition. One of the questions was the definition of disability data. I still worry. I talked briefly about self-declaration. I still worry about some of that. Just people not feeling confident. So I was talking to a young woman recently who wears hearing aids, and nobody in work knew that she wore aids because she spent 10 years hiding it from people, and the stress of that was huge. Because she thought people were treated differently. And then when it eventually came out, actually, if she was really lucky, don't get me wrong, you know, this is a lovely happy ending to the story, which is not real either. But actually everyone just went, oh, okay, and stuff got sorted. So not pretending that's going to happen with everybody, but that comes back to cultural change. But if we don't see more people who look as diverse as society is, we're not going to bring about some of those changes.
Chris? Excellent. I have the power. Taking the data point, if I may, I think it's absolutely critical that we have consistency and completeness of the data, that in terms of the question or any question that is asked, that it's absolutely set within the social model, and that there's a possibility going forward to really deploy the power of machine learning and the other elements of the fourth industrial revolution to help with that data and have some really deep learning into the data sets. The difficulty and the truth at the moment is that data isn't there, and let's be honest, the data isn't there in a large number of cases because there hasn't been enough care. I mean, absolutely care in that sense of this mattering, this being something which everybody's wanting to get after to change. Because I think the thing that united all of the questions so far is that sense that change needs to happen. We need to have much more of a sense that possibility, potential, talent comes out, is enabled, is empowered. As Tani said, you can't get a better example of that than imagine the stress, and as Deborah rightly said as well, that sense of you can only talk about 100% of yourself at work if it truly is an inclusive culture led from the top and everybody taking a leadership role at every level of that organisation. Otherwise, exactly to Deborah's point, it would be absolutely extraordinary to suggest that somebody should be 100% themselves in that environment, 100% themselves where there's hostility or just latent sort of lazy discrimination and everything on that spectrum in between all those points. It would be absolutely ridiculous to suggest that, but as something which is everybody's responsibility, it's certainly a target worth absolutely having in place to, you know, have that approach of people can truly feel that sense of just the lightness of it, as Tani's example said, you know, the sense of you can just, yeah, this is me, cool, it's not a big deal, long way to go.
Thanks, Chris. David?
We just endorse what Chris has said about how creating accepting work environments is obviously hugely important, but we don't know what those organisations look like because very few organisations are actually genuinely inclusive in the way in which I think we'd all like them to be. But I do think we need to be realistic about the steps that we need to take. Coming back to the Stonewall experience about what we've achieved in a relatively short space of time, we didn't think during our lifetimes when Stonewall was set up that we would achieve that change, but actually the steps along the way were really important and we built on those steps. So let's not obviously be so perfectionist that we don't acknowledge that we can take, in some cases, baby steps and make a difference to some people's lives. Two quick points in relation to the carrots and sticks. I think that procurement is a really powerful tool, and I think that public authorities do not use it enough, and we need to hold them to account. They need to impose really strict criteria, and they just don't. And I think it's something I feel very strongly about. There are millions of pounds that are being spent by local authorities, public authorities more generally, and actually it's a driver for huge change, and we need to use the teeth of the legislation that exists and hold not just local authorities, but chief executives to account. So I feel very, very strongly about that, as you can tell. In relation to diversity data, I think employers can be quite canny, and we see this in terms of ethnicity as well as disability, to argue that it's difficult to come up with an adequate definition that's going to work for employers. And this is back to my earlier point about how important it is to take small but important steps. I think that if there was mandatory reporting for ethnicity and disability pay gaps, we'd come up with an acceptable definition which we might refine in future, but it will drive not just the national debate that we've had in terms of gender pay gap reporting, but a huge focus on the importance, the economic case, but also the rightness of what we need to do in our workplaces. And we shouldn't be bashful about this. We need to be less concerned about getting the definitions right than about driving incremental change.
Thank you. Forest of hands. Right, we'll work our way along the front row here.
I'm Sue Groves. I'm here in an independent capacity, but as a civil servant. Three points I really want to make. One, I know Tani mentioned the Disability Confidence Scheme, but I'm actually, having read through that, I'm really uncomfortable with that scheme, because it's self-certificating. And for me, having read through the background of it, you don't even have to have accessible premises, let alone employ any disabled people, to be a disability confident leader. So for me, that scheme doesn't have any teeth. It doesn't work. It's just like ticking a box. Another key thing for me is it's not just about putting things in place for data collection. It's actually changing the mindset of employers. So one thing that's really important to me is let's get our employers and encourage them to stop thinking of reasonable adjustments as an added cost. It's actually an investment in their people. You know, reasonable adjustments are something that they can do for their people if they're disabled, and they get it back tenfold. So it's challenging that belief that, oh God, it's going to cost us. Well, actually, you have to pay to train your staff anyway. So, you know, if you're providing reasonable adjustments for them, why is that not treated the same? And the third point is about access to work and wheelchair provision and things like that. I mean, I found myself in the ludicrous situation with access to work where I needed a power chair. I'm physically unable to manually wheel myself. In order to go through access to work, they made me go to my local wheelchair services provider and produce evidence from them, having gone through a full assessment, that I didn't qualify for a power chair from them before they would even consider it. Now, how much did that cost? I didn't meet the criteria because I can walk short distances. To qualify for a power chair under the wheelchair services, you must be unable to walk at all. Now, that was a ludicrous situation.
Hi, my name is Kush Kanodia. I'm a social entrepreneur and I help a number of charities and nonprofits that focus on disability. So sometimes it feels the narrative from government is that if you're disabled, you're either a superhuman Paralympian or you're a scrounger. And basically those are the two ends. You can either be one or the other and there's nothing in the middle. So my question for you is how, like in relation to contact and awareness to create the sea change in culture, how do we create more disabled role models and help to promote more disabled role models across all industries that we have? Because I believe that will really help to create the sea change in perception and attitude and awareness about how non-disabled people view disabled people.
Hello, Julie J. Charles, Chief Executive of Equalities National Council. I'd like to congratulate my good friend Liz Sace for what she's come up with. I think you've worked really hard and I applaud you for that. I just wanted to make a statement and ask a question to all of yous, really. You know, I've come here today in the pouring rain. I've done a lot of work. I'm tired. And I've got here, and what I've seen are five people that I can't relate to, that don't look like me. However, on a more strategic level, as a businesswoman, as an entrepreneur, as a CEO, I can relate to you. Now, the individuals that we support, I should have said, we're the only national council of BME disabled people in the country. Now, what I wanted to say was that we serve about 2,000 people a year that actually just walk into the office, come into the office for support across the range of service provision. This is not new. What you're saying is not new. And the reason that I get very agitated with it is that we have been banging on all of your doors for about, we're an organisation that's been going for 23 years and we've been ignored. We've been ignored because we're led by BME, disabled people, and it's appalling that we've got to this stage. We're talking about disabled people and employment. If you look at BME disabled people and those that aren't in employment, very much it's a norm. That is a norm. We see it every single day in my organisation. And I just feel very much so, and it will be endorsed by the statistics that we have that come from the Office of National Statistics, okay, that, you know, there is discriminatory practices when it comes to working with disabled people from BME communities who are also from LGBT communities, who also have learning difficulties, who also have, you know, faith. And so it's important that we do look at the whole picture. We do look at the whole picture, but at the same time, I put to the panel, what are you going to do within your organisations to actually work with organisations like ourselves, not being frightened to do so, okay, on a local level and up strategically on a national level, to enhance the lives of BME disabled people to access equal employment opportunities and equal pay opportunities.
Hi, I'm Alison Beck. I'm a master's student here at LSE. I'm really curious to hear the panel's thoughts about self-employment for disabled people, and is there anything that can be done to support people, or that, you know, society could do to make it easier for disabled people to work in the kind of freelance careers where you have to persuade multiple clients to give you work?
Rachel Perkins, Assorted Hats, but moment, I'm particularly interested in employment and people with mental health conditions. And we've talked a lot about employers. I want to talk about the state, because one of the key issues that people with mental health conditions, and indeed an awful lot of health conditions, is the primary impairment is that they fluctuate. So there are periods when you are not able to work, and I'm just tired of seeing the person who has to have is not able to work for 3 months of each year, or 6 months every 2 years, never working, because we have not managed to look at having the pot of money. I mean, in my own independent review, I talked about extending access to work to cover periods of impairment-related absence. And I just think unless we can actually look at that, we're missing out the whole cohort of people, particularly older workers who have a range of health conditions. And it's not that they're not able to work, require adjustments very often at the time, but the impairment is going to be you're not able to work for periods of time. I don't think it's just about cutting up jobs as to how many hours a week. It's something about the state sharing responsibility to actually enable that person to work.
Hilary Farmelo, I'm from spinal injury charity Aspire, and I work on a project to help disabled people get into the leisure industry workforce. A couple of points I want to raise. One, just be interested to know what we can learn from America and Australia in terms of data protection, data collection, as it seems they're one step ahead of us. And the other thing, just in terms of this idea that disabled people should be grateful for being offered a job at all, I think it's really only going to work for the employer and for the disabled person if they are actually have the opportunities to get into work and into careers that they're truly passionate about and where their talents lie. So I'm actually interested in how that whole pipeline develops, looking at those influences at school in early years. People talked about role models, but you know, that sometimes the really narrowed career advice that disabled people are given because they are put into those boxes, and looking at those whole element of training, how accessible is it, you know, whether that's in terms of their initial training and education, but also once they're into the workplace, are those training opportunities for them to grow and develop and become senior leaders also as accessible and open to them as their non-disabled peers?
I'm like Tanny. If I wasn't behind a pillar, I can't easily hide my disability. So on data, I have quite an old 2009 NHS Supply Agency stat of 2% in wheelchairs, and of course DWP 20%, and you say 40% by 2030, but forgive me for focusing on the visible, because then you don't have to any, there's no issues about disclosure. You can see whether you've got 2%. In fact, it's more than that, because first, under prescription, austerity, and secondly, people purchase privately. So I go round, like you might go around looking in football stadiums to see if there are 3% of the population in wheelchairs. Second point, assertiveness. I almost got arrested on Saturday for trying to get on a train. In the 1990s, a career advisor told me to work in employ. I said, no, thank you, I'll do A-levels. I'm going to LSE. So that's a point about education. Lastly, the art of the possible. In the late 90s, LSE told me they could not possibly physically ramp the old building. Lo and behold, I left. They ramped the old building. So if you want a coffee with me, come to Southampton Row. You've got a choice between Nero, Costa and Starbucks. A fish rots from the head. To my shame, Starbucks is universally accessible. Costa and Nero, hit and miss.
Hello, it's Graham Whippy. I will be quick, Whippy by name, Nippy by nature. So I'm a consultant who helps employers be brilliant at employing disabled people, and this is a really quick one. It's really just a plea to David. You mentioned that EHRC is going to be producing a guide for line managers. Well, in the words of Brenda from Bristol, what, another one? We've got them coming out of our ears. Okay, so Channel 4 earlier this year produced a brilliant guide to employing disabled talent. Works across sectors, it's a free download. Office of Disability Issues issued one only a week or so ago. I urge you that if you're going to be spending time and money on doing something, leap over that. Line managers probably aren't going to read it anyway. Could you do something innovative, maybe look at e-learning or something engaging that brings the situation to life rather than just another employment guide?
Just the point, e-learning is incredibly important. If there are lots of guidance out there already, then yeah, I completely agree. EHRC's got better things to do with its money, and we shouldn't be replicating what else exists. So I'm with you entirely. I'll take that back tomorrow.
Chris, one point?
Yep. Take Rachel's point on flexible working. If there was only one thing that we did, and there's obviously many, many more than one thing. One thing which would massively change the situation for disabled people, and indeed, surprise, surprise, for all people, it would be to truly have the right innovative, inclusive, and intelligent approach for a flexible employment for everybody.
Thank you. I think Julie's right. We can't forget the intersectionality, which I think we've all talked about in different ways. I see too often disabled people or people having to pick which strand they think they should be part of, either where they're going to experience most or least discrimination. And this is not a game of top trumps. And, you know, we're all Venn diagrams. And that is too easily forgotten. I'm really happy to meet you. And, yep.
It's last word to you, seems appropriate.
Thank you very much. I'm going to risk making 2 points, if I may. So, first of all, Rachel's point. I mean, at the heart of the report, really, is is the concept that employers and government need in certain ways to take more responsibility. And it's about saying, where it's beyond what you can consider it's reasonable for an employer to do, or beyond what they would consider to be reasonable, government can help them, because it makes sense. You know, one of the, and linking to the self-employment point, there is a charity that links people who have fluctuating and often very significant impairments to job, to work opportunities, contract opportunities, where people might be able to work parts of it. It's better that people work when they can, if they want to, rather than not at all. And there's we've not had good, significant policy on this for a long time, and I think we really need to. Disability Confident, if we had transparent reporting required, and you could see how are these big employers doing, what's it like working for WH Smiths versus working for Channel 4 or whatever, then actually I think you'd have something meaningful for Disability Confident. You know, so you could, then you could see, right, these employers are doing really well, and they could tell their story, and also it would generate lots of role models who were not Paralympian, not only, sorry, Paralympian heroes, sorry, no offence intended. So I think that's why I said when I was speaking that I thought, well, I was suggesting sort of these recommendations kind of went together. We also haven't talked much about kind of reforming the law, but I think there is a place for that. Maybe we can talk about that over a drink. Can I just say finally, I just want to say an absolutely massive thank you to Lisa and Sophia, who are over there, who have been absolutely amazing in planning this event and also organising the publication of this report and things beyond anything you could possibly imagine. I think we should give them a round of applause. And I'd also like to thank Aaron from the International Inequalities Institute and Chris from Joseph Rowntree Foundation for all the fabulous support that you've given this project as well, and the British Sign Language interpreters who've been fabulous, kept up with the pace.
Thank you very much. So I'll join all together then to thank our fantastic panel, thank Liz for all her work in producing this report, and invite you all to join us for a drink. Thank you very much.